two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, are you ready to add a sprinkle of joy to your day? Then you need to check out Add to Cart. Hi, I'm Sujan Pak.
And I'm Kulap Vilaysack. We're your hosts, and on this show, we talk about the things we buy, the things we buy into, and what it says about who we are.
That's right. Each week, we're going to have some honest and maybe, you know, a little TMI conversations about all the fabulous, weird, wonderful things we're adding to or ditching from our carts. You know, we talk about beauty products, latest health trends, philosophies we're passionate about. Nothing is off limits on this podcast.
We're diving deep into everything we and our guests buy into and exploring what it reveals about who we truly are. We're going to decide what's worth the investment, be it money or emotions.
Add to Cart from Lemonada Media has new episodes out on Tuesdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Welcome to In the Bubble. I'm your host, Andy Slavitt. Sanjay Gupta is on the show today. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who is, in my view, I think of him a bit as America's doctor, or an idealized form of that. And we'll get into it a little bit with Sanjay, and you'll hear it in this conversation. And I really strongly urge you to listen to this, because it just feels different to be communicated to by someone who clearly cares about getting it right, cares about how you react to it, cares about our country, cares about us as people. And in an age when people are out there distinguishing themselves by having the loudest voice, the most controversial statement, the edgiest tweet, he somehow manages to distinguish himself by being reasonable and thoughtful and cogent and humble. You can tell I really like the guy. And it's part of the theme that I want to cover today in the sermon a little bit, which is just how we communicate as this pandemic drags on. There's a lot of self-justification. There's a lot of well-intentioned people that I think have some sort of misplaced form of self-righteousness or arrogance. I've caught myself doing that from time to time, and it's really kind of embarrassing to feel like you thought you knew more than you did. You didn't express yourself with as much humility. But it's even worse is not being able to admit that maybe you didn't have it right. And so we're going to introduce a new feature on this show today. You can tell us how you like it. And it's a new feature that we're calling, Come On, People. Can we just move on? And this is a feature intended to combat some of our own arrogance at being unwilling to say the words that cause people to say, hey, somebody said something that was wrong. Now we know differently. It's also meant to acknowledge the amazing amount of energy we spend fighting yesterday's battles. And, you know, I think about someone who's in a position of going on TV and having to say something, and it turns out over time that what they thought about either how the vaccine worked or the virus or a variant or mutation was different than they thought. I can tell you, as someone who's on TV quite a bit, the first thing you think is, well, I was justified in saying that. You know, I said what I thought was best at the time. So come on, folks, give me credit for having good intentions, because And then often that comes across as the next time something changes, you say, well, as I said, or as I said all along, and you try to create this tie to some element of what you said that felt consistent or honest, but it really wasn't what you emphasized. You know, the most significant example is this idea that we knew the vaccines were only going to be really good at preventing hospitalizations. And the truth is, there was a time when we didn't think that. And so we could say, well, hey, you know, they're justified in thinking what we thought at the time. But isn't it easier to just say, hey, okay, I was wrong. We were wrong. And if it helps us just move the F on, maybe we should do that. Now, there's reasons people don't say they're wrong. And you ask them why they don't say they're wrong. It's because they get taken advantage of. Tucker Carlson will say, aha, they were wrong. Aha, they don't know everything. Other reasons people don't say they're wrong is because they think science allows them to change their opinions with new data, which it does. The problem is that not everybody gets that. To people who are distrustful of science to begin with, that just sounds like plain old arrogance. It sounds like a plain old justification for when things change. And if people say, I was never wrong because the scientific process, etc., then I think that leaves a whole bunch of people who are not believers in science sitting back and saying, these guys don't know what they're talking about. And when they get it wrong, they're never willing to admit it. So the next time they come out with something, I'm just going to not believe them because they don't get it right. It's a hard thing. It's a trap. I know a little bit about it because I was, as you may know, listening to the show, I was in the White House with the Biden administration. And at the time, I was charged with, or one of the people charged with, talking to the public directly about the pandemic. And I tried to use plain, simple words, common words, the fewest number of words to make a point to the question of, do we have enough vaccines? Not an answer which says, well, we're going to have enough vaccines when blah, 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 depends on your age, etc. But a shorter way of saying that. No, we don't. We have a shortage. And you'll hear me talk about these examples. I think this communication stuff's important. And our guests today and our guests on Wednesday are just some of the best communicators you'll find. And this is where we go with Sanjay, is a little bit of a health check on the public and a little bit of a check on how do we communicate? How does he communicate? How does Tucker Carlson communicate? And this is very, very important, because if we think science is just about having some amount of facts, but we can't persuade people of those facts, if we can only persuade 75% of people to take the vaccine, then is that a failure of science? People would say no. I say yes, because I say part of science is communicating. And that's why I think the conversation with Sanjay is so great, and I just loved it. So we're going to get into it with Dr. Sanjay Gupta. Here he is. You know, I've said, and I'm not the only one that said it, but I've said, you know, I think of you as America's doctor.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Well, like, in an age when I think there's a lot of people on TV whose stock and trade is controversy, you have this ridiculous formula where your stock and trade is being reasonable, being thoughtful, explaining things to people in a way that shows you care about them, which I think is, that's why I think of you as America's doctor.
Well, that means obviously a lot, and so much more coming from you, Andy. So I really do appreciate that. You know, it is interesting because this conversation maybe even circles around once more, because, you know, I remember when I started doing this business of television reporting. I had done writing before, just for magazines and journal articles and things, but never television. And my wife, again, I found it challenging. And I remember coming to her early on and saying, it's hard, you know, it's abnormal. You're sitting in a studio and you're looking at a lens, and there's no one around, and the lens isn't giving you anything back. Right. They're not nodding. There's no feedback. And so, she reminded me to talk to the lens like I talk to patients. And there was a lot in that, right? I mean, I care about my patient. I want my patient to understand. That's going to affect my word choice. It's going to affect my speed at which I'm speaking. It's going to affect whether I seem like I'm in a hurry or not, you know, speak a little bit more, you know, deliberately. But also, you know, like I would think about the fact that things are nuanced. A patient comes to me and says, what do I got? You know, or what? And it's like, well, here it is, and here are the various ways to approach this, right? And it's a conversation. There's a nuance to it, and it's hardly ever binary. And I think that sort of guidance, saying, hey, talk like you talk to a patient, and you're not gonna. This is what you got to do. In some situations, it's very clear, but most situations, it's nuanced. When you can reflect that, I think, especially during this pandemic, I think it's helpful for people. They appreciate the real knowledge is in the nuance. They can get the headlines anywhere.
So do you picture
the knowledge is in the nuance?
Do you picture like the sort of profile of the person listening to you and watching you as some person or some type of person who is a patient who does come to you and? You know, they're sort of in your hands because they're very uncertain, and they just want it to be okay.
Yeah, I do. I really do think of that person, and I'm always, you know, whenever we talk about, for example, I'll give you an example. In the beginning of the pandemic, I remember a couple times I'd hear people on television say something like, you know, this new disease appears to be affecting primarily older people. Thank God. Or some version like that. And I think, thank God, my parents are watching in Southern Florida. You know, thank God that they're the ones who, you know, I just think it's. I think of like everybody and how anybody might take that. The paranoid side of myself, I'll tell you, just in all honesty, Andy, is that I imagine my professors from med school watching. And making sure that I got it right. Now, some of that getting it right is too much for a television audience. You know, they're not all science professors, but I don't want to get it wrong. So whatever I say shouldn't be wrong, even if it's not the degree of granularity I want to. So that's the paranoid part of me. But mostly it's, you know, I think it does come from a little bit more of an empathetic sort of place, especially given the guidance, you know, my wife gave me.
Well, it shows. It shows.
Thank you.
That and you're just too damn good looking. Like, I think that just knocks people over.
Well, thank you. I just got out of the shower, so I appreciate
that. You look nice. But, I have this image when whether I'm tweeting or talking on television or writing, like, to me, I have this image of a mom of a disabled child. I have, actually, there's a very specific person, but I actually, because I know that like they can't afford for anything to go wrong. They can't afford to miss a detail. They should not be talked down to because they understand, but they also, you can't bullshit them. We don't swear in the show, so I'm sure that'll be bleeped, but you know, they, you can't say, well, this is how the system works. Because they're like, no, I've been there and I get the bill and this happens and the doctor's not there. So it almost reminds me to like avoid the pretense of sounding like there's a clean answer.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you about something that's changed. And I don't know how you think about this, which is this notion of criticism. Like the audience probably does keep you honest, I would imagine, in the sense that like if you did say inadvertently something about, thank God it doesn't affect young people, someone would remind you, are you saying old people don't matter? Like, you get that probably feedback loop. But I think the question is, like, how sensitive to feedback should you be? Because on the one hand, I think, you know, you strike me as a very high emotional quotient person who is listening and taking feedback. On the other hand, there's a lot of people who, like, maybe I'm starting to think, I don't care if they like me. Because, you know what, they're trying to do some of the wrong things. And if we end up pissing them off, this is kind of a conversation with the White House about the president, which is, you know, if you're so worried about not upsetting people who won't take the vaccine, that people who felt like they did the right thing, who got vaccinated, feel ignored, or that you're not taking care of them, then you're losing twice. And so sometimes you kind of have to make a choice and say, you know what, there's people in this country with less access. There's people in this country with fewer choices who can't get vaccinated or whatever. And I got to look out for them.
I totally agree with that part of things. You know, the challenge I think right now, and I want to answer the question directly, but the challenge right now is I don't know who the people are that are criticizing. I mean, I don't know the motivations. I don't even know if they're real, to be honest. I mean, it's just, it's a weird, I feel like I'm living in sort of Westworld sometimes when it comes to, you know, if you're starting to go through social media and look for stuff. I remember that study that came out when they got some discovery on Facebook a few years ago, and they said, well, there were more fake accounts on Facebook than the population of the United States. Now that was the world, but still, I mean, more than 350 million fake accounts. So I do, part of me keeps that in the back of the mind. It's not like I dismiss everything and say, well, that's just some troll or bot or whatever. But, you know, I think that's what has helped me. And it's not something that came naturally, because I think, especially when you're starting off in television, you can be very thin skinned. I mean, it's very, you have to be very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. I mean, and everything, people make fun of your clothes. They make fun of your hair. They make fun of your heritage. They do whatever, you know,
and you're a dude. I mean, for women, I think it's gotta be like merciless.
Worse. It's merciless. So a lot of that stuff I've learned to ignore, which is fine. Although what I will say about that sort of criticism and other criticism is that what I think I've gotten better at is if there's some truth to it, I listen to it and I pay attention, and I think it does make us better. If it's not truthful and it's just, you know, some nonsense, I just delete it. And legitimately move on. Legitimately, not sort of, yeah, I'm moving on. No, I mean it. I like, you asked me about it in a few minutes, 10 minutes, 15, whatever it may be. I really, it's gone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what,
have you learned to do that?
I think that's one of those practice makes perfect sort of things, or practice makes better at least sort of things. I mean, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years. And I didn't think about sort of approaching things that way early on. There were a few periods of time when I felt like I was getting some criticism and I needed to develop a motif or some sort of structure in my own head, at least, of how to deal with that. I couldn't let it paralyze me. I realized that. But I also realized that, you know, maybe there's some if there's some truth to it, then I change. And I'm okay to say that I'm wrong, which I've done on television before.
Sure.
I was wrong on that. I was wrong. And that's a hard thing to say, because no matter what, 10 years later, people will be like, well, that was the guy that was wrong.
Yeah.
How can you trust that guy? Right.
Exactly.
Remember he, here, play the clip over again. I was wrong. And so, okay, I'm willing to take that.
It takes some of the sting away when you say, guess what? I was wrong. Like, what else can you say?
Right.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Welcome to The Dough, where Cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together, because, y'all, Season 2 is here. Hosted every week by me, X-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season 2 of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Look, the moments we regret the most are the moments where we forget the humility. Like, I have these moments where most of the time I'm pretty good at saying, well, this is what I hear, this is what people tell me, but occasionally I'll have said, well, this is what is, right? And with more confidence than I deserve to. And I always regret that. I mean, well, I don't always regret it. When I'm right, I'm like patting myself on the back and running in circles, playing Rocky. But, you know, there are occasions, and this audience doesn't really going to believe this, but I've occasionally been wrong before, too. do you remember that Happy Days when Fonzie said he was wrong? There was a whole episode.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember this?
Yes.
He couldn't get the word out. Yes, too many of us are like that. But
well, you know, you come from a place though where I think, you know, people know you and they know your humility. And I have to say, I want to point out one thing that you did the other day, which I thought was a really instructive for me. Even I think the question that you got asked was something about the appropriateness of rationing healthcare based on vaccination status. Mm-hmm. And because there'd been a bunch of late night comics who had talked about it the night before, and you paused and you basically said, no, that's I believe healthcare is a right. And that means something. And I remember thinking to myself, God, it's so good. It's so good because it is what you stand for. People that know you, and it's a lot of people, and they know that. And then in the moment, I don't know if you'd prep that. No, I don't know.
I didn't expect the question.
Yeah, in the moment, it was just the perfect answer, Andy. And I think that there's times when, you know, we can do all sorts of prep, but I think the reflection of who the person really is comes out in moments like that. And it was perfect. And I made a note to myself that's him, and that's right.
You know, it's interesting. We have these moments where, like, and I watch, you know, you do it, and I found myself simplest to do that is when I get interviewed by really good interviewers, I realize that they're just probably basically the canned stuff comes off as canned. And so figure out what you believe and then let the words come to you real time. And I remember doing one of my first North Lawn interviews from the White House with Fox. And it's funny, it's a true story, Sanjay, that I get on, I put on the headphones, and you know how like there's a talk track where the announcers are talking to each other? And this is mm-hmm. the morning, I think it was Fox and Friends, and they're talking to one another, and he says to her, what do you think of these questions that were written up for this guy? And she says, I think they're kind of weak. He goes, they're very weak. She goes, I'm going to nail this guy. Watch. And they didn't...
Really?
Yeah, they didn't realize I could hear them. And and I was just like, super calm. I mean, because I knew my job was, I could care less about the anchors. My job was to talk to conservatives about the vaccine. So the way he chose to nail me was he said, you know, President Biden hasn't given any credit to Donald Trump for Operation Warp Speed. And I'm going to ask you right here, right now on the spot, do you think that you should tip your hat to Donald Trump? And it is funny. I had just gotten out of a West Wing meeting where people were complaining about Trump taking credit for things that Biden had done. And so, like, if I were a political hack, like, I would have been. I said, of course. I said, look, we should never be stingy with credit. When things work, everybody who had any part in it should have a share in this. And this has been, the mRNA platform has been at work for 2 decades through the Bush administration, through the Obama administration, through the Trump administration, through the Biden administration, private sector, public sector, everybody should feel good. So, yes. So, he was stunned. He was stunned. And he kind of tripped on his words because he expected me to say no. Anyway, here's the funny after effect is I'm leaving the North Lawn, walking back into the West Wing, and my phone buzzes, and there's Politico headline, Slavitt tips hat to Trump.
Oh my gosh! It's all a farce. It's the dog that wags the tail.
Oh, it's crazy.
I mean, tail that wags the dog.
So yes.
Totally. But again, the right answer. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have to expect the headline, I guess, but that's the right answer. And you did at the time too, if I remember. You know, tip the hat or give credit where credit was due.
Yeah, I mean, look. I could recount, and I have in massive detail, how he lied to the country and all these other things. But they did place a bet on 10 vaccines, and they proved to place the bet on some of the right ones. Good mm-hmm. for them. I mean, good. I'm good for us that they made those bets. Let's go back to the health of the country, doctor, because you're in your role as American doctor, like stepping now up to 100,000 feet, and you could take this question anywhere you want to take it. Because it's both related to the pandemic, but it's also related to the mental health impacts. It's related to what's happened with kids in schools, related to a lot of things. Like, diagnose how we're doing as a country. Like, how is our health? Are you concerned about this patient of the American populace?
Yeah, I'm concerned right now. The patient is still in the intensive care unit. If the patient were a country, if the country were a patient, and there have been some, you know, positive indicators, intermittently unstable, but I'm optimistically, guardedly optimistic that the patient's going to continue to improve. There have been some signs recently. The conversations that I've been having with this patient's family have been challenging because inadvertently, some version of this didn't need to happen to this patient always comes up. It's awkward. It's uncomfortable. It makes people feel guilty, but it's true. And you have the conversation because maybe it'll leave a message with the rest of the family to prevent this sort of thing from happening to them. But yeah, I think that it's been a really rocky road for the patient for some time. In the summer of this year, I thought the patient was not out of the hospital, but on the general care floor, maybe even going to head to physical therapy and start getting rehab, things like that. But then the patient ended up back in the intensive care unit. So there's also it's multifactorial, as they say in medicine, in terms of why this is. But I think that's sort of the status of things now. And I look at other patients like my patient around the world, and I see that some of those patients are starting to improve in a way that I anticipate my patient may improve. But by no means out of the woods.
So I'm going to beat this analogy to death here for a second. But like, as you're trying to get a patient to recover, you got a couple of modes, right? One mode is, hey, look, here's the good news. We have some science that if you take it, if you take this medication, you abide by some of these ways of taking care of yourself, you'll get better. And that's the great news. And we couldn't say that in 2020. In 2021, we could say we have an arsenal. It's a growing arsenal. We'll add to it, hopefully with antivirals, so forth. But we have the science. But here's what you can't control as a doctor, and I think in our society where I think we mess up, I think we are more dangerous than the virus. I mean, the virus by itself, if it didn't have people willing to spread it, if it didn't have willing people to say, I don't want to make even a small inconvenience to my life, whether it's getting a rapid test before I get in an airplane, whether it's not going to a wedding unless I've been vaccinated, whether it's putting on a mask before I go to school. If I'm not willing to make a small sacrifice or the equivalent of a lifestyle choice you might give a patient if they're leaving, you know, you're a neurologist, neurosurgeon, so that, you know, there's an equivalent of you have to ask the patient to do it. And by the way, all the medicine in the world isn't going to help you if you're not willing to go through these rehab steps, and they're tough. It's called breaking your routine. Where I get pessimistic is all of the good science in the world isn't going to make us better if we're not willing to help ourselves.
I think it was it Asimov, the science fiction writer, that said he'd always end with some version of, you know, the greatest threat to mankind is mankind, you know? I mean, I think we think of the natural evolution of our species as one that's headed towards us arc of increasing perfection and making the right decisions and self-sustenance. And yet, you know, we're taking a lot of detours on this evolutionary path that make us question, you know, whether or not we're going to sort of self-destruct. Yeah, I agree. But I think, Andy, if the ultimate question you're asking is, should you still do it? I think you still do it. You still sit there with the patient and really convince them of these things. You don't know if it'll leave a mark or if it'll leave a mark now. Maybe it is a piece of evidence that patient collects along with other evidence that ultimately is a preponderance of evidence that makes the patient start doing these right things. So yeah, I think that I would never give up in terms of continuing to give that message. In fact, even more so probably, you know, like the people who are already hearing me, that's great. And I'm glad they've heard me. In some ways, the obligation now is to up my game and try and get the message to people who aren't hearing me or haven't heard me or, you know, I think can be convinced. I will say one thing, and this is just from a practical sense. I think there's probably, like if you're talking about the vaccine specifically, let's say, I think there's a certain percentage that will not be convinced. And I think you have to accept that because I think you can bang your head against the wall over and over again, trying to convince that small, you know, that remaining percentage, whatever it is, 20%, 15%, you know, depending on which poll you look at, say no way, no how are they ever going to do this, and not let that suck up so much of your energy and resources where you have, you know, whatever percent that's more movable on this issue. So, you know, we did this documentary before the pandemic on vaccine resistance as related to the measles outbreak. And I interviewed all these people and went all around the country and in Brooklyn. You remember, it was in the Orthodox Jewish community. It was in Minnesota, where you formerly were, among the Somali community. It was so fascinating to talk about why people wouldn't take the vaccine. But it was really instructive, you know, for me to have those conversations. So I would never give up in terms of trying to get my patient to rehab and making sure they do everything they can to stay out of the hospital.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
A couple of really amazing points you make here, which I agree with. One of them is you're never going to get everybody. And guess what? The math isn't going to convince people. Shaming people isn't going to convince people. And so to a certain extent, you've got to try other things. And by the way, have other tools in the arsenal, right? That besides the vaccine. But, you know, the sad reality is that means COVID's here longer. COVID has more chances to create variants. Those are just simple facts that we're going to have to figure out how to wrestle with. But the thing you also said that I think is I wonder how you process this, is just our ability to have a dialogue in a peaceful way, even to disagree in a way that's respectful, where you could say, you know what, I really wish you'd reconsider, whether you're talking to your patient or you're talking to the audience, and they say, you know what, I have my reasons for not. And you don't think they're a dummy because they're not doing it, and they don't think you're out to coerce them and, you know, be a totalitarian state for that reason. But that dialogue, you know, and this speaks to directly kind of what you do every day on CNN, is, you know, you got a bunch of people who for a long time said what you do is fake news because you're on CNN. You got people who only watch Fox News, people who only watch CNN, and this sort of demonization. And how do we cross that? Or is too much made of that? Is it really not that big of a threat?
I don't know. I think I don't know that we're making too much of it. It's been surprising how interlaced I think the politics and the science have been. I don't think you can disentangle just about any part of this pandemic story, even the very scientific parts, from politics. So I think it's real, and I do think it's concerning. I mean, you know, I live in Georgia. It's a red state, I have people that I know really well who have not been vaccinated. You know, people who are smart people, not a lot of them don't talk to me about it. Like if I run into them somewhere, they're not, you know, hey, by the way, I didn't get vaccinated. They don't want to pick that discussion, let me say, with me. But I know that they're not. And I will tell you, Andy, I don't think I've even relatives of mine, on my wife's side of the family. So it's really, it's interesting to me how pervasive it is. So I don't think we're making more of it. I think it's real. But I think, you know, I had this story the other day. Our air conditioning broke in our house, and it's really hot, and we needed a guy to come fix it. And this guy shows up. He's in his mid-70s, seems like, and nice guy, really nice guy. He's wearing a mask and everything. He goes, and he's working on the air conditioning, and then at the end, I'm walking him out. And I didn't know if he knew who I was or cared or anything, but it seems that he did, because he said, "Hey, do you mind if I ask you a question?" And I said, "Sure." He goes, "Should I get vaccinated?" And I said, "Yeah, you should. I mean, there's really no reason not to. You know, there was some concern about allergies early on. I sort of talked him through it." And he said, "Well, the reason I ask is because I have a stent in my leg. And you know, I heard there was some concern about blood clots forming from the vaccine." Mm-hmm. You know, he probably heard about the J&J, you know, sort of trial maybe a few months earlier. And I said, "Yep, that's true. But it was really rare. It was primarily in postmenopausal women. And when you look at it, the risk of a clot is far, far greater from getting COVID than from the vaccine." So, and then he says to me, Andy, he says, "You know, my daughter died last week of COVID. Oh. And before she went on the ventilator, she begged me to get vaccinated. And I really want to get vaccinated. But I didn't know about this clot issue. And I've been calling my doctor. I haven't heard back from my doctor's office. And you're the first person I saw since my daughter died. So I'm asking you." And it was like, man, that was powerful emotion.
Powerful.
Kind of hit me in the chest, you know, really, really powerful. And but it also reminded me, like you were saying at the beginning of this conversation, like I do imagine that guy listening when I'm talking about right. it. And if I say, "Hey, these guys are just all terrible, they're just reluctant, they're just hurting America and all that," some have just totally politicized it, but not everyone. And I think, you know, those are the reachable folks. That guy will probably be vaccinated, you know. I'm sure right. he's maybe vaccinated by now, which is great.
Right. Well, it is a powerful story, and it reminds us that most people have questions that they believe are legitimate. Now,
yeah,
people who are maybe more informed might say, "That's not a legitimate question. Of course that's not the case." But the fact that you drew him out and he talked about what he heard, and then, you know, the next thing, the question I ask people is, "Where can I get you information from someone you trust? Who do you trust?" Now, the fact right. that he asked you, and that you're a physician and you're well-known, was great, because he had finally had someone to ask the question to who he trusted. But, you know, the guy doesn't want to die. Nobody wants to die. He saw his daughter die. Yeah. He had to know that this was serious. And he obviously wasn't doing it for what he thought was a legitimate concern.
I mean, I always wonder, on any given night, how many people are watching the news in America? You got, what, 350 million people? I don't even know what the numbers are, ratings, but I would guess it's far less than 10%.
It is, yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, all the news, broadcast, cable, everything.
You're not counting Tucker Carlson. So, I'm kidding.
Right. Yes, but you know, many are getting their stuff from social media. They're getting right. it from whatever, their newspapers, smaller and smaller. Point is, like, I was thinking about that guy a lot. Like, he hadn't heard anything. He's never really watching. He's working all day. He goes home. He's probably tired. He's not watching this stuff. He's probably not reading about it, because you know what? It's depressing to read about. So it's not like he's going to go out there and search for COVID stories. So how does a guy like that get educated? There's a larger issue here, I think, you know, just in terms of the overall knowledge flow in general, even outside of a pandemic, for people.
Here's the problem, and I know this because of my battles with Facebook from the White House, is this is where algorithms are poisonous and insidious. So if he went into Facebook and said, "Concern about blood clot from vaccine," the algorithm will give him exactly what the people who have been out there trying to plant doubts want that person to get. So let's say you're 90% sure, Sanjay, that you want to get a vaccine, but you're kind of needle phobic. If you went to Facebook, you would see this picture of the giant needle, close up, super thick, probably not even the needle used for a vaccine and from the 1940s. If I went there and I wasn't needle phobic, I'd never see that. So part of the problem is, this algorithm is designed to get people the wrong information at exactly the right time. And people the people, and it is perpetuated by a relatively small number of people who really know how these engines work and knows how this game works. So if they could get someone with a little bit of doubt to see that that doubt has merit, they've done their jobs.
Why do they do it? I mean, and I don't mean to sound naive, but like, you sell a product and like, I'm going to show you a Ford ad every time you like Google car, right? Like I get, like I'm being really blockheaded, but I'm just saying they're not selling anything except fear, right? And doubt. How is that a strategy?
So
what are they selling really?
So now you're getting into the patient, like what's going on in the patient with this theoretical American patient we're talking about in a really interesting way, because you know, there are a set of people, large set of people, you call it QAnon, but I don't try to typecast it even to say, well, maybe I'll typecast it a little bit, that has, that sowing chaos against the establishment is an end in of itself. And that was is a larger block of people than I think we ever knew. And look, by the way, the way they weren't born cynical, right? So you'd have to go back and say, well, what happened over this patient's lifespan? What was it? The financial crisis, and they lost her house. Was it, you know, being lied to about the Iraq and Afghanistan? Was it, you know, what are all the accumulation of events that led us down this path? Was it the closing of, you know, was it trade that closed, you know, a lot of things in rural communities? Was it immigration, you know, that they caused them to see immigrants as the other? But there is a, and look, this is probably the crowd that watches Fox News. And so, you know, they're probably not watching your show every day, you know, and you know, so I don't think there's any financial aim. I think they've been, but I think that there doesn't have to be that many of them. Social media is a playground for trouble for those folks.
I mean, if chaos is the goal, that obviously really like widens the umbrella of all the nefarious things, you know, that come under, you know, that will lead to that. But I mean, like, so if you take this, if you continue this metaphor and you think, okay, the vaccine, and you got to ask that question about tipping the hat on Operation Warp Speed. But let's say, you know, President Trump had taken a lot of credit and, you know, gotten the vaccine on television, or, you know, made it very publicly known and advocated for it. Would chaos still be the goal? I mean, I guess, like I'm saying, chaos to what end? Was it to support a particular political party?
I've come to believe, you know, I mean, I think of politics as a reflection of culture as opposed to the other way around. And I've come to believe that as a populist, Trump has very few of his own original ideas. I think he has a couple. Like, I think he's a protectionist. I think he's anti-immigrant. I think he comes by those things more honestly. But I think other than that, he's putting his finger in the wind and he's sensing these cultural shifts that exist, and he's riding those waves. I don't think he much cares. Do I think he respects people in West Virginia that vote for him by 70 points? I don't see them invited to his golf course in New Jersey. I think he is a populist in the kind of classic sense of someone who knows how to play to the crowd. When you see him, you know, back when he had a Twitter account, he was constantly testing what could create responses for his own, because of the roar of the crowd. So I don't think Trump had the power to go against the grain. I think that grain, that 20% of people that you talk about, was pre-resistant, and he can't afford to isolate him and leave him alone, which is why even when he says get vaccinated, he has to keep one foot in the camp. But freedom, gotta keep freedom going, because those are the people that have buttered his bread. He can't lead them to a better place, because that's not him. They're leading him.
Right. Right. And then if you get back to what you were saying about the chaos sort of instigators, that's leading as well. It's not that they're acting with some purpose other than to create chaos, but then somebody may start to follow them because it generates a lot of energy or a lot of movement or momentum, whatever. And it's dead wrong, like showing the big needle to a guy who's thinking about getting the vaccine. Like it's nothing but harmful at that point. That's the part that I find just so. If I'm pessimistic about anything, it's that.
Yeah.
Because I feel like otherwise we would sort of, you know, it would be very logical just as a species to want to take care of each other, find order, realize that, you know, survival of the fittest was never actually a thing, that, you know, reciprocal altruism was really the only way we were going to survive and thrive as a species. That's just natural. Everything else that's happening
is unnatural. And most of us do. Most of us do. I mean,
right.
Looking at the election in California, and yes, I get it's California, but a 2-to-1, Larry Elder made this about the management of the pandemic, and Gavin Newsom said, that's fine with me. Let's make this about the management of the pandemic. And yes, it's California, but I live in California. There are massively rural and conservative parts of this state. He was blown away. And so I'm a little bit encouraged that we're talking about a small vocal minority. We're talking about absolutely it's self-fulfilling. So there are cultures, you know, there are towns where nobody's vaccinated or very few people are vaccinated. And that's the way of life. By the way, it was that way with smallpox, as you know, for years in the U.S. That we've got these cultural pockets. And, you know, who we are as a country, are we an enlightened self-help, support each other nation? Yes. Are we a racist, xenophobic nation? Unfortunately, we're also that too. And we've got these forces that the battle's going to continue, because I don't think that they're consistent themes. But to your point, does that mean we stop or does that mean we keep going? We absolutely keep going and model that. And look, I just asked the question, does it feel better when you do something for yourself that's really selfish and you get what you want? Or does it feel better when you do something generous, when you do something kind? What makes you feel better?
Yeah. No, it's obvious. When I've done something nice for somebody else, I genuinely feel good. And I find that, I think...
You get a rush of warmth. You get a rush of warmth. Right.
I mean, so if you continue that, you know, sort of say, so that's interesting, right? Because why did that trait get selected for in the evolution of our species, right? Why when I do something for somebody else, would that feel good? Because it should be about me, right? It's survival of the fittest. And yet somehow that trait was selected for. And I love that.
Yeah.
I love it. You know, it's part of our DNA. It's part of who we are as human beings. That's why
cool
everything else feels unnatural.
That's a cool way to look at it.
Yeah,
I hadn't thought about that.
It is a cool way to look at it, and I think it relieves anxiety sometimes when I'm starting to feel anxious about things. That, you know, fundamentally we are wired to be altruistic toward one another. That is how we are wired. Other things aren't happening, but they're the abomination. You know, so it makes me happier, and I have kids, and I'm excited sometimes to see how they respond to things in a way that makes me very proud as a dad about these big issues, right? You know, showing their empathy in moments where it wasn't canned. They really needed to make a decision. Being altruistic towards someone else, you know. So, yeah, there are some more optimistic things that I think about during this pandemic as well.
Yeah. And look, there's no reason why people shouldn't turn on TV, see you, and see the way you talk about things, even difficult things, even challenges, and say, yes, I know this is challenging for people. I understand how people feel, but here's the good news, or here's the facts, or here's the opportunity, or, you know, we get through this challenge, you know, until we get through this challenge, it's going to be difficult. Like, people feel better. And you do that for people. Now, I mentioned Tucker Carlson briefly, kind of tongue in cheek, but how do you explain, like, that guy? Like, first of all, Fox News has a vaccine requirement and a daily testing requirement, come to find out. And, like, I understand Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Like, there are people who are like, this is what they believe, I'm not going to diagnose it, whatever. But, like, Tucker Carlson, you know, and I had this conversation with the people at Facebook because they promote him endlessly, is like, you know, I feel like he's doing the opposite of what you're doing. He's planting mistrust. He's planting doubts. He's giving people reasons to suspect. He's just and he's a very popular figure.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, just in the context of things as well, which is always worth reminding people, it's still maybe 2% of the country a night that are watching him. It's, you know, I think we talk, and I get that it's shared in different ways and all that, and obviously a lot of people know who he is, but it's not, you know, I think sometimes we look at things as being totally representative of the country or a society, and they're not. They just get a lot of attention. Kind of like you were saying, you know, earlier, that most people are actually doing the right thing, but a smaller percentage will get a lot of attention. I think, you know, Andy, I think television news is it's a tough business, and I think, you know, he clearly it's one of these things where I think he knows who his audience is, and he's saying the things that his audience wants to hear. It's a little bit of the tail that wags the dog again. You know, is it leading or is it basically in enabling? And right. I think that's I think with some of these folks, they really do feel strongly about what they're saying, but I don't think there's that many of them actually. They are saying they feel strongly only because they know it'll rally a certain segment of the population. And that's it's easy. It's a little bit, you know, it's not that hard to do.
Right.
You can say these types of things and know that. I think we have a, you know, I think there should be a larger obligation when you're saying things to a lot of people at once on television. I really feel like, you know, the fact checking and the vetting and the thinking and all that, giving numbers, being accurate, I think it matters, you know, and to find, you know, you had 100 studies, you find one study that says something different and you say, we're leading with that tonight. You know, that type of thing kind of makes me a little crazy. You say, right. Well, hang on, that's not how science works, but it can be how television sometimes works.
He must think it's just like an hour performance and his job is to succeed in that hour. And look, I mean, I know I could tweet something that could get 200,000 likes by just putting right. something really edgy out there. You know that there's times where you could get a viral clip by, you know, calling someone out, just being a tiny bit edgy. The problem is that's addicting. Is that when people, some people like him taste that becomes the end in of itself. And that just negates people that are out there to do really responsible things. Thank God that people watch your network and watch you for other reasons. And, you know, not everybody could pull it off. I mean, people are edgier because it's easier. It's just simple. You don't have to think.
Yeah, and you know, when you're a reporter, and I'm a reporter, not an anchor, but when I'm a reporter, sometimes the question will be framed in a way that is to elicit something that's quite like they did to you, right? You know, will you tip your hat to Trump, you know, right now here? So every now and then you'll get those sorts of questions. And I think, you know, I mean, that's life. You know, I feel like I get those questions on TV. I might get those questions in person, you know, if I'm at an event or something like that. And that's life. You just got to feel like you can answer those things. And having a North Star, I think, helps. And if you don't know, saying you don't know helps, you know, as opposed to, you know, trying to answer something you're not right. equipped to answer. But it's more challenging, I think, than I've ever seen it in 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. And there's been other challenging times. This isn't, you know, the only time, but it's that entanglement has at times really surprised me. It's really surprised me. I remember when, I think it was a study that came out of Columbia, basically a modeling study talking about how many lives would be saved if we went to universal masking. And they said if it was a whatever number of weeks, it would be 40,000 right. lives right. saved. And I just remember thinking to myself, so, okay, let's say you hear the message and you say, okay, if I just put 2 ear loops on when I walk out the door, I could be part of a movement that saves 40,000 lives. And you had a bunch of people saying, I'll pass. Ain't gonna do it. I was like, what is happening? Like,
that's not rational. That's a good value proposition.
That's not rational. And I have a lot of relatives, by the way, that live overseas. And so we'll have these conversations. You know, you can get in the bubble, so to speak, right here in where I live, but then in this country as well. And then you hear other people sort of looking in on you through the glass bowl, and right. Man, it looks ridiculous.
They don't get it. Yeah. So I had this thing I did with my 19-year-old son, Zach, who used to be my co-host on the show before he decided to go to the thing called college. And we did this thing where I just asked him to calculate for me, because he's kind of a mathy kid. Like, if the R-naught was when it was a 2.3, if you reduce the R-naught from 2.3 to 1.3, calculate the impact. And so he basically said over 10 generations, one person at a 2.3 will infect 41,000 people. If you just infect the average number of people, then you go 10 generations. That's how the exponential math works. Hmm. And so then you say, okay, well, let's say 0.5% of those people died, just 0.5%. That's 20 lives. Okay. So, and then if you go down to 1.3 and you only affect 1.3 people, after 10 generations, only 14 people are infected. Because 1.3 times 14 doesn't get you to the 10th, doesn't get you very far. Right. So that would be like, maybe call it one person dying. So it said, okay, so wait a minute. So we're basically saying, Zach, that you've got 20 people's lives in your hands based upon what you do. I'm just trying to, because we're trying to boil it down to the average person instead of saying yeah. hundreds of thousands of deaths, saying right. you, as every individual, have, if someone said to you, hey, Sanjay, I know a way you can save 20 people's lives. You'd be, I'm in. What do I have to do? Yeah. I got to stamp all. No, you got to wear a mask. You got to not breathe on people, and avoid crowds during heavy periods, right? 20 people, because we don't see those people. But I thought it was pretty. I just got to carry that around, you know.
Yeah, it's a really good way of framing it. I think that it's feels very empowering to people. And, you know, your son is just a little bit older than my daughter's, but I do think that people resonate with different things. Although I think anybody would sort of get that, it seems, you know, it's just, maybe that would have been sort of the key, even with this Columbia study, instead of saying, hey, be part right. of a movement that saves 40,000, you yourself.
Yeah.
By the way, wasn't that how your podcast started? I remember you and Zach sitting around talking about that. Yeah. I can't remember if you talked about it on TV or I just heard you.
Well, yeah. And it started because, like, the kid literally was out of choices of things to do. And he's like, hey, Dad, we should do a podcast. And I was like, the last time my kid has said, hey, Dad, we should, I can't even remember. So I was like, if you could have said, hey, Dad, let's mulch the yard, I'd have a mulching business right now, but he said, let's do a podcast. And so it was really fun. It was a fun project for us during the pandemic. Speaking of the podcast,
that's great.
I want to add a new feature to our podcast, and I'm going to do it starting at this episode. Okay. And it's called Let's Move On, People. Okay. Let's Move On, People. And here's how it works. Okay. We all learned something at one point during the pandemic, and it was like, okay, it turned out we should be taking the vaccine 2 weeks apart. Okay, now we know that we should take the vaccine longer periods apart. It helps more. Okay, so that was wrong then. We now have new facts, okay? Now, should we spend our energy? Is it healthy for us to spend our energy, Sanjay, dwelling on the fact that we thought it was 2 weeks, but it turns out it should be longer? Or should we just move on and adjust to the new information? Go ahead.
I think we should move on, and here's why. I think there was actually, as I learned since then from because I dug into this, you know, I don't know that I would have even called it wrong, that the interval, I guess Pfizer 3 weeks and Moderna 4 weeks, whatever it is. What I understood after sitting down and really talking to people, including going back to Moncef Slaoui, but also people like Barney Graham at the NIH, mm-hmm. I really wanted to understand this because I looked at vaccine schedules. And I may be giving you an answer that's longer than you want, so
no,
I apologize.
It's perfect.
But when I look at vaccine schedules for other vaccines, you know, it is true that many of them do have multiple shots and separated by, you know, some quite some duration. But what I thought was interesting is that, you know, if you talk to someone like Peter Hotez, he will say they were always going to need to boost at, you know, 6, 7, 8 months, whatever, like much longer period away. That was always going to be part of the plan. And say, well, why did they do it at 3 weeks then, right? He said, well, because they gave a shot and then they saw they were getting 64-65% efficacy, which was really good, but realized that even though it was a really short interval, if they gave another shot within 3 or 4 weeks, they really were raising those neutralizing antibodies and getting closer to 90%+ protection against severe illness. So he's like, that it was like we're in the middle of a disaster.
4,000 people were dying every day.
Yeah. So we will go ahead and just fortify the gates as much as we can right away.
Guess how long it would have taken to study a vaccine interval that was 6 months apart? Four months.
Exactly.
So
I don't think it's wrong. So I think that the question for me becomes, I don't think it's wrong. I think there's a nuance there again.
But here's the thing.
What I think was...
Don't go ahead.
I think it wasn't explained very well in the beginning. That's the thing. I think if a booster was always going to be part of the plan, I think they should have said it. They didn't have to say, hey, you know, it's going to be exactly 6 months, whatever. But in the future, you will need a booster for this
shot. Here's the deal with this feature of this show. The deal with the feature of this show is to say, fine, we were wrong, we were nuanced, whatever. Fine. Okay, but now we know. Different. So let's move on. And you know why we should move on? Because we're alive.
Yeah.
660,000 people aren't, and they can't move on. But now we know, and there may be very good explainable reasons for it. There may be terrible reasons for it. I'll give you another one. The COVID vaccine is 96% good at protecting against symptoms. Okay, well, now it turns out it wanes, and it turns out that Delta has a quicker incubation period, and more people are getting breakthrough infections. Okay, is the vaccine still saving people's lives? Okay, can we just move on? I mean, do we have to, or should we wallow in the fact that the vaccine works differently than we thought it does? I'm voting here on this feature of this episode to say, hey, folks, let's just move on, people. Let's move on. Let's call it wrong. But Anthony Fauci said we should not wear masks in February of 2020. Can we talk about that for 10 years?
Right.
And never put on a mask because he said that? Or should we say, okay, fine, now we know better. Let's just move on.
I second the motion. I totally agree with you. It's a waste of time. It's being used to basically discredit everything else that comes out of somebody's mouth because they got this one thing, quote unquote, wrong. You know, and you know, you and I, because we've been so immersed in this, I've been so head down. Any of these topics you raise are an entire podcast. But as you point out, you know, when you talk to Fauci about masks, there was two things. Ultimately, he'd never seen a respiratory virus that spread so efficiently asymptomatically.
Yep.
That was a big thing for him. And you know, look, the guy's been doing it for a long time. I always say to people, I say, okay, so I get that maybe you don't trust the guy. I'm just saying, let's say you're a Martian and you come to planet Earth and you're like, okay, I'm observing society. I want to figure out who are the best people to trust.
Right.
You know, I'm going to pick that multi-billionaire guy who's pillaging, you know, communities around him to make more and more money. Probably not. I'm going to look at, you know, whatever sector of society over here. A government scientist who stays on a government salary for 40 years, just toiling away, looking at emerging infectious diseases, has done work on previous plagues like HIV/AIDS. And for, you know, he's 80 years old. He's been doing this a long time. Yeah, put him pretty high on the list.
Yeah.
Right? I pretty high on the list. So why is it that the what's, you know?
I think so.
It's the chaos
maybe. But I wonder, and I say this to Tony, is I wonder, like, we spent, instead of us spending the time explaining why we thought the time, I'm ready to go, fine. I called it wrong. They had good intentions, I had bad intentions. I'm now saying wear a mask, okay? Can we move on now? Like, if I acknowledge, call it wrong. Call it whatever you want. But you know, at some level, this need to keep having the debate or the argument where Tony has to say, well, but I hadn't seen this. I didn't know it was asymptomatic. I didn't know we have enough masks. Okay, fine. You're right. I was a total moron. I'm the dumbest person in the world. Okay. Now, can we move on, please, and wear masks? I mean,
right.
This is where I can get, we're like so obsessed with this, like, and caught up in this battle over the past that I'm like, okay, pretend the pandemic started today, okay? The pandemic started today and we had all the knowledge we have today. We know a lot more about vaccines. We know a lot more about masks. We know a lot more about a lot of things. Let's just act accordingly. So I want to give people the permission to cleanse themselves of all those bad feelings, feeling misled, feeling misinterpreted, and just say, hey, folks, say it with me, Sanjay. Let's move on, people.
Let's move on, people. Let's move on. I love it. I love this feature. And you're in a perfect position to sort of champion this feature. It is a really interesting way to think about just sort of tabula rasa. Let's just start right now. And we have a lot of knowledge. Right. Let's not dwell in there because it's not accomplishing anything either.
Let's just save the next person. Area. Let's save the next person's life. Let's prevent the next death. That we have the power to do. We can't do it as well if we're caught up in, I get this was an exhausting 18 months, and it's been an exhausting and trying and scary period, and we've got anger, we got unresolved issues, and we're like pissed off that our kid did go to school when we think they should have, and we're pissed off that their kid did go to school when they shouldn't, and pissed off that the teacher, I've got all those emotions, and this is maybe where we should begin to wrap up if the conversation is, they need a place to go, like those emotions need a place to go. Like we have, well, whether we would call it PTSD formally or whether we would just call it anger issues, what we call it, places where we, you know, each one of us feels like there's a point in time when we were right and the country did something wrong and we're now, see, I knew we shouldn't have closed the schools. I knew that this, I knew that nursing homes, I knew this, I knew. And so like we've got all this like energy that people are going to have to expend to move on in a healthy way. So maybe as we kind of close, it kind of goes back to where we started about the patient. How do we help the patient psychologically, from a wellness standpoint, from a caring standpoint, let some of these things go?
Well, you know, I'd say a couple things. One is that I do think that to this point you're raising about, I was right on this, I got it. You know, you guys, you know, you didn't get it. I think that people do want to be recognized. They want credit. You know, I think it's a very human sort of instinct. And if they feel like they've been diminished or they've been ignored, that just fuels that sentiment, I think, even more. So instead of arguing, I think, you know, giving credit where credit's due, I guess kind of like you know, you were telling your story, I think it does sort of level the field a little bit. You know, I think sometimes there was this poll that came out, Andy, that Dr. Fauci actually shared with me about attitudes towards scientists. And one of the headlines for him was that they have been increasingly seen as arrogant. Scientists increasingly seen as arrogant. And I thought that's a good note for me to remember because, you know, if you just give some credit, yeah, you were right on that, you know. So we were learning back then. I think the other thing is that We are going to get through this, and I think that, you know, if it feels so gloom and doom all the time when people watch or are reading these stories, then I think even if they're very interested, eventually they start to just tune it out. It doesn't leave as much of an impression. So I think that for the patient, I would be constantly reminding them of that as well. I mean, maybe there were moments during this pandemic where I thought legitimately things are really heading south, you know, in terms of the patient care, but I'm optimistic. And I think I need to reflect that and share that with my patient to make sure they know that and give credit where credit is due. I mean, there's been a lot of people who've been involved with this pandemic that have, you know, you get, you're on the task force, you're doing these things, people see you, but there's a lot of people out there who've been part of this that have tried to contribute as well. Maybe not always in meaningful ways, but in ways that I think sometimes deserve credit. And
no, I did it all myself. I mean, right? I'm the only one that can fix this, isn't that the saying?
I don't totally disagree with that, by the way. I think like I just want to say that when you, I think I texted you, but when you left, I don't want to, I'll just leave it. When you left, things changed a little bit, I think, in terms of the cohesiveness of the task force.
That's nice.
I shouldn't say anymore.
No. I think they've got a very, very tough, these are very tough things, very tough job to do. And, you know, this idea that you have of working our way through it, all of us, and finding a way to heal, as we do try to put this past us, or accept the reality that life is going to be a tiny bit different, more inconveniences, to mourn people we lost, to listen to the doctors and nurses on the front line who didn't get listened to and who have real perspective, to not sweep this under the rug when it's gone, or when it's calmed down. But I feel like whatever, my advice to people listening to this show is the same advice I'd give to myself and my kids, is there are things that heal us all, and they're different for each one of us. And you know, there are kind of things you talk about and have talked about historically, that perhaps people haven't paid as much attention to in terms of their own wellness and self-care, and that are concepts that sometimes we think, well, who's got time for that? Hmm. But maybe, you know, we ought to be rethinking that and to take care of ourselves and take care of each other better.
Well, you know, I do think that it's very important and possible to have the conversation about why the United States, for example, had such unhealthy sort of population to begin with, that put us in a much worse position in terms of handling this pandemic. I think it, like everything else, it gets wrapped up into issues that don't shaming and blaming and things like that. Obesity was a big risk factor for outcomes with regard to this disease, and you know, it hasn't gotten enough attention. And it's multifactorial again. There's people who simply do not have, you know, healthy food very available to them, living in these food deserts and things like that. We spent $4 trillion on healthcare. 70% of disease is preventable. If we spent 1% of that budget on making sure people had healthy food, it would go a long way towards that. But we don't do those things either in this country, you know. It's reflective of a larger problem. But are we allowed to have a conversation saying, yes, the people who are most vulnerable to this disease were people who are more likely to have been sick from other, you know, comorbidities in the first place, and we can actually do something about a lot of that? I think it is reasonable to have that conversation and to be really, really empowering about it. What is it about your microbiome that actually is generating your immunity or helping your immunity? How does your breakfast today help the likelihood that you'd have a better outcome if you got COVID tonight? You know, things like that. I'm exaggerating a bit, but there's real connections there. And I think we did in some ways it's like the patients in the ICU for a heart attack, probably not the time to start telling the guy to stop eating cheeseburgers. Right. I'll get to that, you know, but now is the time, I think, to get to that with the country as a whole. That has to be part of this conversation going forward. Wealth does not buy health. I think we've realized that, or been reminded of that, at least during this pandemic. Diseases of affluence, like we see in, you know, in the Western world, were really, really significant risk factors for this disease. And that's a lesson. You know, we've learned it before, but we've been really reminded of it here. And I think, hopefully, as part of all the public health, you know, spending that has now been approved, that's going to be part of it.
Yeah.
You know, making sure that the basics in terms of allowing people to show up at a pandemic fight well-suited, some of those things are addressed.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't say this lightly, but I would be more than comforted to know that whatever we face as a country, you're going to be there to help lead us through it, both personally and as a society. I can think of very few people who are better trusted with good reason. I do have to ask you one thing before I go, and I hope you'll be willing to take, if you had to give one word answer to this question.
Okay.
Lab or bat?
Bat.
All right. Interesting. Everybody watch your special, and everybody should watch your special. There's nuances to beat you, and I only gave you one word, which is unfair, but I appreciate you answering it.
Well, if you got to, you know, if you got to gamble on things, and if you're asking me to like hedge my bet, then I would say that, which, you know, I think is fair. It's a fair question. You know, I the thing that just strikes me so much, the only innuendo here for me is that I really think this most likely came from a natural origin. What I can't figure out is why there's such opacity with regard to that lab from China. It's suspicious for sure. Yeah. Why not just let a forensics go in there? Why not reveal blood samples? Why not put up the database? All of that, you know, people who follow the story know what I'm talking about. Yeah. But these are,
I think that not? I could understand why that makes people suspicious, But people remind me, people who've studied China for a long time and who've worked with China for a long time on many fronts, that this is just not the Chinese way. They don't do that. In SARS-1, they didn't do that. And we didn't, as you know, we didn't know the origin for years. And it turned out that it was of natural origin. So it does make the world look askance. It makes me look askance. It doesn't make me very happy. But I don't know the answer to the question I'll ever bat, but I do think that's their behavior would probably be the same either way. And most important right now, in my mind, with China, is to figure out how to collaborate with them to vaccinate the globe.
Yes.
Figure this out afterwards. But right now, let's finish the job. And we need to work with them, not where we are today, where we just are throwing barbs back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be another one of these, you know, and it most likely will emanate from China. I mean, that's where you're getting a lot of the zoonosis happening, regardless of whether those viruses are being studied in a lab or not. And if it's just so toxic, then I think we're going to go back to SARS-1 days where, you know, it took months to really understand what was going on. Yeah. At least there was I don't know how fast they actually told us things this time, but it seems to have been faster than during SARS-1 at least. So I think it's really important. And the WHO has to be empowered. And they can't even get into China. They say they want to do a phase 2 investigation. Right. China says, no. So what now? What do you do?
Can't do it. Well, maybe you'll come back sometime on the show, talk some more. This was really fun. I love
Anytime.
Where this conversation went.
I have a lot of respect for you, Andy. I really do. How you've lived your life, the things you've chosen to contribute to. I mean, we need people like you, and also just the way that you teach. Because, like I said, I watch you, and I feel like I can see how your mind works sometimes, and it's really instructive and helpful to me.
Thank you. I really appreciate you saying that. It's quite mutual, and I look forward to spending more time working on all these important things together.
You got it. I'm here for you anytime. Thanks for having me.
Now, that was really nice conversation with Sanjay. I mean, not everything has to be like a huge heated argument, i.e. David Agus, big arguer. It's just civil people out there. Some tough issues. Yes, people are dying and people are getting sick. And the politics is a little bit nuts sometimes. But there are civil people that you can have conversations with. So I'm applauding Sanjay. No, I'm not just... I'm tipping my hat to Sanjay. That's an inside joke. Okay, who do we have coming up on the show? Three people coming up on the show. If you don't know them, you will know them soon and you'll love them. Catherine Wu from The Atlantic. A phenomenal journalist, communicator. She's writing about what we can expect in winter. That's what we're going to talk with her about. Celine Gounder. She is a physician in New York. She has a great podcast. She was part of the transition team. And then Ashish Jha. Oh, we're going to have fun with Ashish Jha. Oh, we're going to have some fun with Ashish Jha. Okay. Thanks all. Talk Wednesday. Thanks for listening to In the Bubble. Hope you rate us highly on your podcast apps. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease and Alex McCohen produced the show. Our mix is by Ivan Kuriev. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax are the executive producers of this show. We love them dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media. And you can find me at aslavitt on Twitter or at andyslavitt on Instagram. If you do like what you heard today, please tell your friends and please stay safe, share some joy. We will definitely get through this together.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Pod Crush are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, friends, it's Meghan Trainor.
And her big bro, Ryan Trainor.
And her husband, Daryl Sabara.
Each week on our podcast, Working On It, we share behind-the-scenes stories and bring you into our hilarious and heartfelt conversations, and sometimes with amazing guests.
We tackle everything from navigating Hollywood to mental health to Meghan becoming a mother, Daryl becoming a father, and so much more.
We'll get into the nitty-gritty of our lives and leave no detail behind. Prepare to laugh, cry, and hopefully learn something new.
Listen to new episodes out every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.